The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes Willie Noyles, columnist for View magazine, the weekly newspaper, and we're going to talk about the Drummond Report on the day it was introduced. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
You were saying there are 362 recommendations?
Yeah, something like that. There's definitely over 360-odd recommendations. The vast majority of them deal with health care, which, considering it makes up 42% of the provincial budget, it's not surprising.
Okay.
He wants, basically, the government to keep to a 2.5% increase per year in health care, which, as he himself admits, has never been achieved by any other government before.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how far they'll get. Some of the recommendations are good, but others are what you would call structural. In other words, it'll take a number of years before you would even get it set up and before you would even realize any savings.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But ultimately, what he's suggesting is that the government focus on prevention rather than hospital care.
What an excellent idea.
Mm-hmm. And start focusing on home care as opposed to being in the hospital.
Well, in theory, those aren't bad ideas. What's your opinion?
No, they're not bad ideas. In fact, there's some really good ideas in there.
Okay.
Like he mentions in the report, you have a number of people in hospital beds who shouldn't even be there. They should be in long-term care.
Yeah. But he doesn't have a solution for that. He simply says they should be, right?
Yeah, that's part of the problem, because in order to put them in long-term care, the government's basically going to have to build more long-term care homes.
Yeah.
Which, let's face it, is going to cost money.
No kidding. All right.
Now, it's on the capital side, but still, it's money that would have to be expended.
Mm-hmm. Before any savings?
Yeah, in some cases, yeah.
Okay.
Because some of these are, like I said, structural in nature, so you're going to have to do a lot of consolidation in that, and of course it'll be years before you would even realize some of the savings.
Right.
Some of the more controversial healthcare ones are things like closing more hospitals.
Yeah.
Which we know goes over like a lead balloon in many areas.
Especially in your area.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first thing I thought of was South Niagara. And in fact, the supervisor that the government appointed actually had stated less than 3 weeks ago that he believes that Niagara needs a new hospital in South Niagara.
Uh-huh.
Well, if we're closing hospitals, I don't see us building any new ones.
Yeah, they did it with schools. They closed three, they built one.
And schools are also other things that he recommends being closed.
All right.
And which, of course, as we know, there's a number of school closures going on already that aren't exactly going over well.
No.
But he starts off basically by talking about the fact that if the government does nothing over the next 5 years, the deficit will grow to $30 billion.
And it now is 16?
Yeah, it's 16 at the moment.
Okay.
I was almost thinking I'm watching a really bad episode of Till Death Do Us Part.
All right.
Where she always starts talking about the worst case scenario if nothing was touched for the next 5 years.
Okay.
Only a lunatic would not do anything over the next 5 years.
Yes, or a passive aggressive. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay.
But ultimately, as he himself admits, it is draconian.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the last time that there were serious cuts in Ontario, this time we wouldn't have the luxury of being able to jack up spending once those next 5 years are over.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the problem is more that, A, we have a lower productivity in Ontario than in most other provinces.
Really?
And, B, we can no longer count on growth to basically fund our way out of a recession as we have in previous decades.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the big problem we have now, because he's estimating a growth rate of 2%.
That much came through, yeah.
Over the next 6 years.
Yeah.
Some other private economists say it could be closer to 2.5, but either way, you're still looking at significant savings that are going to have to be made.
Of course, he's not concerned with outcomes, right? He's concerned with means and financial results. He doesn't say anything about outcomes for clients.
Yeah, basically, because like he said, his job wasn't to look at the political ramifications. His job was basically to make recommendations.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see, A, whether the government's going to have the political will to do this,
mm-hmm.
and whether the opposition will join them in getting it passed.
Interesting.
I know that Andrea Horvath has already come out, and what she's basically saying is that if you're going to do this, you make these cuts, you can't do it without also ending the corporate tax cuts.
Right. Absolutely. I'll buy that.
The Tories basically are saying that as far as they're concerned, everything is on the table.
Right.
And they're also pushing for the idea of ending any corporate welfare gains or programs. But at the same time, they still want the government to continue the corporate tax cuts, which, to my way of thinking, it's corporate welfare regardless of whether you call it a tax cut or a job stimulus program.
Okay, yeah. I'll buy that.
So it's nice that the Tories want to try and have it both ways, but not a surprise either.
Yeah. Well, I didn't hear anything from the Tories about cutting MPP salaries, though. I mean, that's a token gesture, but when you're proposing harsh medicine, it helps it go down.
Yeah.
What about the dreaded social supports and social programs?
Okay. Well, he talked about the fact that spending on social programs has risen by 6% over the past 5 years, but he admits that a lot of that has to do with the uploading that has recently taken place over the last couple of years.
Okay.
In a number of areas, what he is suggesting is that he will leave it up to the Social Assistance Review Commission to make their recommendations.
Oh.
But the one thing he does focus on is that he believes that Ontario Works and Ontario Disability Support Program would be better off melded together with additional supports for those who are disabled as opposed to those that are just on general welfare.
What a refreshingly new idea. Not more than, 6 years after we did, or was it 16 years after we did the reverse? Yes.
Yes.
And how does he, oh, I see. So he's thinking they both go to the same base rate, and then you make that up with special supports.
He doesn't really tackle benefits, but it's pretty clear if you read between the lines that he's proposing no increases for the next umpteen years.
Yeah. So in effect,
and he also
decreases.
Focuses on the fact that they should treat Employment Ontario as including everyone, because he believes that more people that are on ODSP could be working.
Okay. So what is Employment Ontario? This is the free back to work program for people on EI and so forth?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what he's suggesting is that if you include everyone in those services, then it makes it, it takes away the stigma of somebody having to identify as being on welfare or Ontario disability.
Oh, but if they're on one or the other, it's still a fixed income, right? And you're still a bum.
Yeah.
I mean, the stigma doesn't go away just by wishing it away.
I know.
Yeah. And if you join the same program as other unemployed people, I hate to suggest this, but maybe you taint them as bums too, whereas now they're just people looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dear. So,
and, of course, the other thing that he's not even taking into consideration here is that the reason that welfare rates have increased is because there are no jobs out there.
I'm surprised he didn't mention that. I mean, where does he get, you know, I think, well... Look, I'm not a guy to praise McGuinty, but if the expenditure increase over the last 5 years has only been 6%, he's either a magician or he's a liar, and it may be lying to, you know, you and me or fixed income recipients, or he may be lying to himself. But 6% increase in the middle of the worst recession since the 1930s is a remarkable achievement.
That's the overall increase for social programs, period.
In fact, it's unbelievable.
And and there's apparently been a 5% increase on a yearly basis for ODSP.
Okay. So most of the increase is in ODSP.
Yeah.
You say 5% on a yearly basis. Is that 5% times 5 years? No.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure where he's getting these numbers.
No.
And basically, he puts the blame down to the court decisions that have expanded the eligibility requirements for ODSP.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? So we'd like to see those people living on under $600 a month. Yeah, yeah. Of course, he doesn't deal with benefits. That would be too, you know.
He starts off by talking the fact that these programs are really necessary.
Yeah.
But that at the same time, we can't afford them.
Yeah. It seems to be a conflict of interest there.
And what he's suggesting is for those who are unable to work that are on ODSP, he's suggesting that they be on a federal program.
Oh, that's cute.
That's a wonderful idea. It's pie in the sky, because I don't see the feds creating a new program to help anybody.
Not right now, no.
No, so that's a fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I see the feds, you know, I'd like to be on a separate federal program, you know, well-funded with an indexed pension and all. Sounds almost like a federal job, you know. Yeah, yeah. They've got problems with that already.
And for those that receive the Ontario Child Benefit, he's recommending that the increase that was promised in the 2011 budget not take place.
Oh, so it was promised a year ago, and he's recommending it not take place. And don't they still claw back part of that, or have the clawbacks ended?
That I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I know that with the restructuring that they took away
the winter clothing allowance
stuff and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're supposed to save $2.37 or something a month to achieve that every year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many people can do that on, let's face it, three kids, $1,700 a month. I mean, that's, you know, how can you keep anything in the bank on that? And if you can, how can you keep it there for 12 months?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's saying that it's easy has never tried it. Okay, so he's talking like what he is, a bank economist. And now Dalton has to deal with the fallout from this.
Yeah.
What is there that he's left out that Dalton can seize on? Anything?
No. Like, he's included everything in there, and basically what he's saying is that if the government actually wants to reduce the, eliminate the deficit by 2017-18, then they have to implement all the recommendations, or if they don't choose one recommendation, they have to find the savings from some other area to balance it out.
Right. What about green power?
He's basically saying that the government should end that 10% discount that they're giving right now for hydro users.
Oh, okay.
So, which basically means people's hydro bills would increase 10% right off the bat.
Well, if it's 10% reduction and you reverse it, it's what's 1 in 9? It's an 11% increase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And plus, the government had already admitted, even before the election, that hydro rates are scheduled to increase about 8% each year.
Right.
So no, I think basically be looking at an 18% increase right off the bat.
Well, that would be the end of him. The NDP would have him.
Some of the other things that he talked about was charging user fees for students who ride buses to school.
Meaning what?
Parents should now pay towards that.
No, oh, I see. School buses. School buses, yeah. I see. So it's not part of your education anymore. It's an extra privilege. And if you don't want it, you can always walk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, like, I automatically thought of Niagara here. They opened, they called the Niagara District School Board Academy.
All right.
Which was basically what some have dubbed the poor school.
Okay.
Where they're bringing all these students from low-income families from across the region into one central school in Welland.
All right.
Well, if these kids are from low-income families to begin with, and they're having to be bused in from across the region, and you're now going to charge them bus fare?
Yeah.
Like, that's an insult.
Well, it kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that probably won't fly. I hope it won't fly.
Yeah, because you would have that problem for low-income families regardless of where they live.
That's right. And rural families are notoriously moderate income.
So, yeah, exactly.
So if you give exemptions for low income, you've essentially nullified your surcharge for using the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
He also recommends that class sizes be increased in schools.
Oh, the parents will like that.
Yeah. That we cut textbooks.
Meaning what?
I'm assuming that means that parents pay for them.
Oh, I see.
They also suggest getting rid of anybody who's not a teacher in the school.
I see.
So it's vague, though, as to what he means by that. Does he mean social workers? Does he mean caretakers?
Yeah.
Does he mean secretaries? Like, what does he mean by non-teaching staff?
Yeah. Welcome to the Niagara Academy. Your broom is in the corner. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Here, start paying your way through school. You're going to start cleaning it every day.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I can see him negotiating with the teachers union on that with no problem at all.
Yeah.
Very good. Oh dear. What about medical care? You said there were some problems there.
Well, with medical care, what they're suggesting is that we focus on home care as opposed to hospitals. They also suggest making use of nurse practitioners and nurses instead of always having to use a doctor.
Right. I'm not looking forward. I mean, I deal with that over the pharmacist counter now, and it's no fun.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
He also suggests that the ODB program be income tested instead of just automatically giving it to people who are 65.
Well, if they could set a reasonable income test level, I mean, that would go very well. But you know, they won't.
Yeah, that's a concern right there.
Yeah. So his viewpoint on hospitals is that basically they should, as near as possible, they should just go away. He hasn't addressed the question of LHINs or administration or coordination or joint budgets or something.
He's suggesting that more things be taken care of by the LHINs.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a concern to me because I don't trust these LHINs.
Well, aren't they the ones that closed your emergency rooms?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've got the wonderful Hamilton Niagara LHIN where they were holding consultations in grocery stores and on golf courses and calling that consultation.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. They got wrapped by the auditor last year for that.
Okay.
Plus, of course, wonderful expenses.
But he wants to give them more power and authority. He doesn't say anything about electing them or anything like that either, right?
No, and see, that's the problem, because these LHINs are unelected, appointed bodies.
Right. Yeah, not really answerable to the public whose health they have
exactly.
In their hands. Yeah. Okay, break. We have the unmistakable guitar of Duane Eddy. And fittingly for the Drummond Report and the hardships ahead, the Peter Gunn theme. We'll be right back. So what's your overall view of this? Welcome to Greece West? And is it doable? Is it not doable? Is it political suicide? Is it McGinty's
to choose? Some of the recommendations would be political suicide.
All right.
I tend to think that this is something that we've definitely got to cut the deficit. There's no arguing that. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But I think it's how you get there and how long it takes to get there, I think, is where there could be disagreements.
That's nicely put, yes.
Because personally, I don't see why we can't delay eliminating that deficit by a year or two.
Yeah. Well, ask anyone in the streets of Athens what they think.
Yeah.
Canadians are nice people, and they don't like to be violent. But if you threaten their livelihoods and their lives, you know, it could be a new chapter in this province.
Yeah, because I have a feeling that with some of these recommendations, you're going to see activists out in the street like you've never seen before.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Well, any fiddling with the fixed income that looks like it's going to be cuts. You see, Drummond is living in a dreamland. A lot of self-sustaining people have this image that because you're getting money, it's enough for what you need.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can't imagine that you would be given money deliberately that wasn't enough for what you need. So if what you get is enough for what you need, then maybe you can, like any other good Ontario cottager, you can just cut back a little bit, you know, a little less of finer scotch, a little fewer steaks, you know, maybe sort of thing, yeah. Maybe a more modest car the next time, you know. And they don't get it at all. They don't. They have no idea. I see people every night in the coffee shop who live on less than $600 a month, and they're disabled, and they can't get on ODSP.
Yeah.
So how are they going to qualify for a whole fan of extra supports, which they have to qualify for individually while they're sick on an income that doesn't permit them to survive? This is cruelty, institutionalized cruelty.
Yep, because as I said before, he's not suggesting benefits be cut, but at the same time, it's basically between the lines he's saying no increases.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you talk about no increases for the next God knows how many years, that equates to a real cut.
Well, especially after 16, 18 years of no increases.
Yeah.
I mean, put it this way, no effective increases.
We'll
acknowledge the odd 1 or 2% that we get in the face of 3 or 5% inflation, and especially food inflation, which is a bigger proportion of fixed income recipients' budgets. But we won't call it an increase.
Because right now, people are less well off than they were under Harris.
Yes. Yeah. And he at least was honest about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I never thought I'd say that. But this, I've said it before, I'll say it again. This, what we have today is a passive-aggressive government. It's a government that smiles and nods and makes promises and then just sweeps them all under the rug and the devil take the hindmost. Top off the 16 years of no effective increases with more years of no increases, you're making some pretty broad assumptions about how people survive.
Yeah.
And assumptions that beg to be disabused, frankly.
Yeah. And the other aspect of this is that basically, because what he's suggesting is that he's recommending that total social spending be limited to 0.5% a year.
Oh, I see. We've been pouring money into the economy. We are to ignore the fact that we've been experiencing quite surprising food inflation and anticipating bigger general inflation and give people who don't have enough 0.5% a year. I see. McGinty's going to have a hard time. He's asked for this. He's asked for these recommendations.
Yep.
Now he's going to have a real hard time saying, well, I know I asked for them. And he's already said it. I know I asked for them, but I really don't want them. What he said is, it's up to Drummond to make suggestions, and it's up for me to choose. But that,
yeah, Duncan repeated that line himself this aft as well.
Yeah. So what he, yeah, he's already said, I know I asked for it, but I don't want it anymore. And then he's got to face the numbers, which will, you know, silently impeach him if he doesn't do it.
I have a feeling that what he's going to do is he's going to use a lot of the Drummond report for political cover.
Oh, okay.
And what he can do then is he doesn't have to make as drastic of cuts as proposed, and then he looks like a political hero because he didn't hash and slash as broadly as he could have.
Oh, well, yeah, that's politically wise.
That's one theory anyway.
Yeah, okay.
My concern with the social spending limited to 0.5% is it's basically precluding the Social Assistance Review Commission from recommending any increases to benefits.
I wonder if that was intended.
I wonder that myself.
Yeah, and I wonder how high up it was intended.
Yeah,
interesting point.
If the commission, if the Social Assistance Review Commission proposes anything new that's going to cost money, it's obviously not going to happen for a number of years.
Yeah, right.
In which case raises the question of why did we waste the money and get people's hopes up over it? There's a part of me that almost thinks that that whole commission was basically an exercise to get him through an election without getting people up in arms.
Yeah, that's been said. So, yeah, you're...
The sad thing is, though, that with this Drummond report now and the size of the deficit and the government still insisting that they're going to balance the budget by 2017, they're basically... leaving, they're basically straitjacketing that Social Assistance Review Commission.
Well, and they're generating in a minority situation with an election possible any time that any of the other parties feels it has the money to fight one.
Yeah,
they've come back and created a worse influence than they had at the election. If they faced the facts at the election, maybe people would have said, my God, he's got a spine after all. I'll vote for him one more time. I know he didn't come through the last two, but maybe he will this time. But no, you know, he didn't do it. He set up this commission, and now he's going to say, in effect, ha ha, I was only kidding.
Yeah.
And the public, nobody will take to that. Not the hardline conservatives, not the soft liberals, nobody.
Yeah, exactly.
He's kind of put his foot in it. That sucking sound you hear is him going up to the knee. No, really.
I know.
Who will we get, though?
Yeah.
Hudak's been reanointed.
Yeah, if Hudak wins the next election, it'll only be the same.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've heard that Ontario has stopped growing at the rate that it used to, and they're saying that immigrants are choosing to go elsewhere. I wonder if, like the Maritimes, we're also beginning to feel an out-migration, or if that is still to come.
Well, definitely the fact that we've lost so much of our manufacturing base
right.
hasn't helped.
No, no.
The... parity with the dollar in the U.S. doesn't help.
No.
And the government's hydro experiments where hydro rates have gone through the roof hasn't helped business either.
No. Okay.
Well, because if you're running a big mill, you're going to be using a lot of power, and if you're paying through the nose for it, there's no way you can do that and still pay employees.
No, it's got to be passed on because it's overhead.
Yeah.
Or you've got to eat it, which means you don't make any money. And what's the point of running a big mill if you're not making any money for years? Yeah. Interesting.
Like, I agree with the idea of green energy.
Yeah.
What I disagree with was the way the government went about it.
Well, we're stuck with the result.
Yeah, I know.
Result for now. We can look forward to the NDP and the Greens and the
And we're stuck with all the contracts that they signed.
I gather that a lot of them are coming up for renewal.
Some of them are.
Okay.
And in which case, they're going to have to look at how much they're actually allowing these people to make off selling to the grid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because the green energy is proving to be extremely expensive compared to the other forms of hydro generation.
Yeah, well, it could be extremely expensive to encourage people to do business with the Ontario government and then tell them that it's a losing proposition.
Yeah.
I heard rumors about breaking off the beer store.
The one thing that was proposed in of the recommendations was that the LCBO should open more stores.
Oh, yeah.
And that they should negotiate better rates.
Okay.
For their product, which I don't think anybody would disagree with except maybe the LCBO.
Right.
And the other recommendation they're making is that there be more chances for people to gamble in places other than a casino or the racetrack.
What, like while you're waiting for your prescription, you can play the slots?
Yeah, I almost wonder.
Okay. Well, shoppers would welcome it. I mean, it would be a nice counter to the cut in generic drug prices.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was a good idea. I'm no politician, I'm no economist, but I thought as opposed to splitting off the whole liquor operation, it seemed workable. And I'm surprised we've heard nothing about it. Either that means that they're working very seriously on it, or it's a no-go. And I don't know.
Well, then
we'll
again,
see.
The beer store's a private enterprise.
That's true, too. So they'd have to come to terms with multinationals to accomplish this. And that would be tough. Yeah. Well, I don't know. What? Multinationals came to terms with us in London with Caterpillar. Why couldn't we come to terms with multinationals? Anyway. Interesting review. What's your overall view?
My overall take is that some of these are going to be necessary.
Yeah.
Some of them actually would be good.
All right.
Others I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole.
What's the proportion? 50-50?
I'm not sure I would go 50-50, but definitely there's a good 30-40% I wouldn't touch.
Okay. So we're talking, say, two-thirds of the recommendations. What does that mean? That means 1.5 times the weight that we'd propose. So instead of 2,000, I'm throwing spitballs now, but if it's 2017 that we're working towards and it's 2012, all of a sudden it's 2020 before we get, and we still have grief in the meantime by implementing 60-70% of those suggestions. That's probably a realistic, you know, given that I have no data to back it up, and I'll be quite frankly admit that, that's probably a realistic perception. And as you say, political cover in the meantime, what he's going to try and sell what he doesn't cut as the defining character of his administration. Oh, I don't know. It all sounds so Canadian.
Now, one of the things that the Drummond Report was not allowed to touch or recommend was taxation.
Oh, okay.
But right there, I would tend to agree with Andrea Horvath that if we're expecting all these other cuts, then there's no way we should be decreasing the corporate taxes any further than they already are.
Oh, and for that, McGuinty strikes a deal that he needs as a minority government. That sounds very, very likely.
Well, I know there's already been trial balloons from the government about freezing the corporate taxes at their present rate of, I believe it's 11%, instead of decreasing them any further over the next 2 years to, I believe it's 10.5 or something.
Okay, yeah.
Which would save $800 million. It's really not a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Drummond proposed that doctors not be increased any further in their fees for this coming year.
Apparently they've done quite well with fees.
Yes, they have. Okay. And I can't see why they couldn't go with no increase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, whether the government has the guts to stand up to them is the other question.
Yeah.
And Drummond also proposes that the government get public sector salaries in line. And that's more like the heads of OPG and that are making over $1 million a year.
Well, and it's OPSU and QIPI, too.
Yeah, and hospital CEOs.
Yeah.
Like, that's where a lot of the increases to health care have been coming, is in the terms of these salaries to these hospital executives that really should not be making what they are.
Don't you think, though, that given the number of hospital executives, that the amount of their salaries is a... it's a symbolic reduction. Yes, it needs to be made, but it's really just egg on their face that they let it happen. It's not the answer to their deficit problem.
Yeah, it's not going to give you a huge amount of money, but definitely they shouldn't be left alone.
No.
And just with OPG, like if we were to cut that guy's salary in half, you're saving $500 million a year.
Yeah.
That's basically, you could probably increase social assistance rates by 1% with that $500 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we're going to look after anybody, I think it should be the less fortunate instead of some guy who's gotten used to making $1 million a year on the public purse.
Okay. I'll take that as a sum up. Was there anything else you wanted to say about this?
We're looking at a number of years of really brutal cuts.
Yeah. Okay. I think he's trying to get Ontarians used to that, but it's not a scenario Ontario's ever had to face in living memory.
Yeah, it's definitely hard, cold medicine. And even Drummond had to admit that in some ways it was a doom and gloom report.
Right.
But I think we have to look on the positive side.
Right.
We've got to stay positive. If we are to stay negative and resign ourselves to umpteen years of cutbacks and growth rate of less than 2%, it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's true, too. Yes. Okay.
I think we all want the economy to grow.
Yeah.
And with the economy growing, A, you've got more dollars coming into general revenue. You've also got welfare rates that would go down because people would have a real job instead of having to depend on poverty.
Yep.
Below poverty rate wages to survive.
Yeah. Even more part-time jobs would ease the welfare burden.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hesitate to think more part-time jobs when there are people who are stuck in them and need full-time jobs. But, I mean, it's a ladder, isn't it? The people in part-time hopefully move into full-time or more time, and the people who don't have any move in to take their place, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a hopeful scenario. And I really appreciate you doing this with me at 12:25 p.m. I guess it's a.m., right? 12:25 a.m. On Thursday morning. Who would believe it? Well,
we're nuts.
Okay, have a good night's sleep.
You too.
All right.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to View Columnist Will Noyles talk about the Drummond Report released yesterday, recommending something like 362 ways McGinty can cut the budget. Woo. And now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. These are not the newspaper stories that we read to you, but these are adaptations for radio. The authors, the reporters, and the newspapers that we adapt from are given in the broadcast. Athens burns as austerity bill passes. Athens erupted in flames, tear gas, and pitched street battles between police and protesters as the Greek government pleaded for, and later won, a crucial parliamentary vote that will prevent the ailing country from defaulting next month on its crushing debt. The final tally was 199 votes in favor and 74 against in the 300-member parliament. Even though the government, led by interim leader Loukas Papademos, handily won the vote, the anti-austerity protests are not expected to die away in the next few months. The anti-austerity protest began peacefully in the late afternoon in Syntagma Square, facing the parliament buildings, but turned unruly quickly. The 5,000-man police army, provoked by flying bottles, stones, and oranges plucked from trees, were quick to detonate tear gas canisters and stun grenades. Fires gutted no fewer than 5 buildings and as many as 12, according to late reports, in the downtown core. Streets were covered in rubble by rock-throwing protesters and overturned garbage bins were set on fire. By about 9 p.m. Sunday local time, there were reports of about 50 to 100 injuries. One report said 40 police were injured, 2 seriously. That by Eric Gregulli in Athens in the Globe and Mail. Reforms prompt call for Spanish protests. Madrid. Spain's biggest unions called for mass protests across the country this Sunday in response to labor market challenges the government announced Friday to reduce the country's towering unemployment rate and spur economic growth. The government on Friday approved a decree that will, among other things, dramatically lower the cost of laying off newly contracted workers and facilitate company plans to reduce their workers' wages or dismiss them en masse. The decree also makes it easier for companies in difficulties to opt out of wage bargaining agreements with unions and gives priority to company-level wage agreements over sector-level or national accords. It also offers a series of new tax incentives to encourage the hiring of unemployed youth. The government says the overhauls will help spur hiring at a time when Spain's unemployment rate is nearly 23%, the highest in Western Europe, while close to half of all youth looking for work are jobless. Spiraling unemployment, along with a runaway budget deficit, has spooked investors and sent Spain's borrowing costs shooting upward. Spain's gross national domestic product shrank 0.3% in the fourth quarter from the previous one. And that by Dow Jones and Company, again, in the Globe and Mail. Austerity may fuel labor unrest, McGinty warns. Ottawa. The Premier used a lunch speech here to issue one of his strongest warnings yet that civil servants won't escape the province's looming belt tightening. With $55 billion a year going to salaries, half of the province's annual spending, McGinty said any effort to rein in spending must include wages. And he suggested tough talks ahead as Queen's Park engages with provincial employees. Asked whether bureaucrats should brace for job cuts or salary rollbacks, McGinty said any specifics would be unveiled in the provincial budget, expected in late March. Despite the hurt caused by the recent global recession, Ontario continues its tradition of punching above its weight in the Federation, McGinty said, quoting from the expected Drummond Report. What does this mean? It means that the federal government persistently transfers large resources out of the province for redistribution elsewhere in the country. It means that other parts of Canada are able to provide programs and services that we Ontarians do not enjoy. That story by Bruce Campion-Smith, Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Toronto Star. Deaf man cleared of G20 charges. The Crown has withdrawn criminal charges against Imodimi Azorbo, the deaf man who says his charter rights were violated when he was arrested at a G20 protest and then denied access to an adequate interpreter. Azorbo, now 32, was watching a G20 protest near Yonge and College Streets on June 25, 2010, when he failed to hear police commands and got in a physical confrontation with officers. He was arrested and taken to the G20 Temporary Detention Center on Eastern Avenue, where Azorbo says he was denied access to a professionally trained interpreter. Azorbo was charged with assaulting police officers and resisting arrest and was scheduled to begin trial, but the Finch Avenue Courthouse, Crown Attorney Jason Miller, withdrew all the charges. Miller told the court Azorbo was not involved in the protest and could not hear police instructions, nor could he effectively communicate to officers that he was deaf. But Miller played two YouTube videos for the courtroom. One captures Azorbo walking toward police and being struck and pushed away, only to reapproach the officers. What happens next is mostly obscured by the crowd. Despite being given a couple chances by police to calm down and walk away, Mr. Azorbo persisted in pushing police officers and finally shoved an officer aside who was blocking his progress, Miller said. But Azorbo maintains that what police interpreted as aggression and pushing were his frustrated attempts at communicating with officers and defending himself. "I was trying to explain that I was deaf," Azorbo said, speaking to the Star through an interpretation team that includes an American Sign Language interpreter and a deaf interpreter. "And then I was being pushed, and all of a sudden I was taken down." Azorbo's lawyer, Howard Morton, also filed a charter motion alleging his client was denied his constitutional rights, including his right to the assistance of an interpreter during legal proceedings. Morton said his client was further denied access to interpreters at two of his subsequent court dates when interpreters ordered by the judge failed to show up. Gary Malkowski with the Canadian Hearing Society said his organization offered to provide Toronto police with interpreting services during the G20 weekend, paying thousands of dollars to keep qualified interpreters on standby. But when they offered interpretation services for Azorbo, they were denied, Malkowski said. There was not only a denial of rights, but an intentional denial of rights, he said. Azorbo says, "I assumed that police would do right by me and have an interpreter. I assumed that they would be aware of my rights and make sure I was protected, but they weren't." And that by Jennifer Yang, staff reporter for the Toronto Star. Victim's family trying to figure out what happened. Michael Elagon Jr. remains mostly a man of mystery several days after he was fatally shot in a confrontation with police while wearing a hospital gown on an East End street blocks from the hospital. Most important, it's not been revealed how he ended up at Toronto East General Hospital and how he came to flee Friday morning, clad in hospital gown, socks, and carrying two pairs of scissors. Privacy laws prevent the hospital from commenting on Elagon's status there. "He was very quiet," said a man named Mario, the building manager where Elagon lived in the Dufferin and King Streets area. "He wouldn't talk much. He would only talk to you if you talked to him first." He said he was surprised to learn about Elagon's death and the circumstances behind it. After leaving the hospital, the 5'11", 160-pound man is believed to have injured someone inside a nearby convenience store before trying to hijack a car. Shortly after, neighbors on nearby Milderton Boulevard reported that a man in a hospital gown was trying to break into a house at the back door. Witnesses reported several officers surrounded the man on the street at around 10:15 a.m. Elagon was carrying two pairs of scissors, according to witnesses, and kept walking toward the officers with his hands outstretched, despite being ordered to stop as police backed up. Three shots were fired and Elagon dropped to the road. He was taken to St. Michael's Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Although police were never called at Elagon's apartment, he had a brush with the law in 2009. On December 15, 2009, Elagon was arrested and charged with assault, sexual assault, forcible confinement, and threatening death, court records show. His 18-year-old girlfriend at the time was the complainant. Elagon was acquitted of all charges on October 7, 2010. That by Curtis Rush, police reporter for the Toronto Star, with files from Shantai Alec. Police to present new cause of death. Fearing jurors might rule Junior Manon's death a homicide, a Toronto police lawyer will introduce testimony at the inquest from a prominent U.S. pathologist that says the teen died of exhaustion and heart arrhythmia. Manon died after a brief foot chase and violent scuffle with Constable Michael Adams and Sergeant Stuart Blower in May 2010. Dr. Palanin, Ontario's chief forensic pathologist, ruled the cause of death was positional asphyxia, caused by pressure placed on the teen's chest after he was taken or fell to the ground during the arrest. The Special Investigations Unit, the police watchdog, cleared the officers of criminal wrongdoing. Police lawyer Gary Cluley said Palanin's conclusions as to the cause of death were based on eyewitness reports, which he suggested could be inaccurate. Many witnesses reported the officers used their weight to restrain Manon on the ground, but both testified that was never the case. Jurors could rule the death a homicide if there is no other cause of death put forward, said Cluley. If there is no alternate theory advanced, it doesn't have the air of reality. It has the air of inevitability. Manon, 18, was stopped by police while driving on Steeles Avenue West, but fled when Adams and Blower tried to arrest him for driving, a breach of his bail conditions. He was arrested after a short foot chase by police down Founders Road, just south of Steeles Avenue West. That by Patty Winsa, staff reporter for the Toronto Star. Plea deal kept secret from Crown, jury told. Kofi Barnes, now a provincial court judge, was the Crown, who supervised 10 federal prosecutors at Old City Hall, including Beverly Olesko, who took Christopher Quigley's guilty plea on June 3, 1998. Quigley, 46, has testified that on April 30th and May 1st, 1998, drug squad officers Richard Benoit and Ned Mayotis, supervised by their boss, Detective John Scherzer, viciously kicked, punched, and choked him to unconsciousness as they demanded where he kept his drugs and money. He was treated in hospital for his injuries, but was charged with assaulting police as well as possession of marijuana for the purposes of trafficking, possession of marijuana, and proceeds of crime. But he was able to plead guilty to just one pot possession count, paying a $1,000 fine. Before he pleaded guilty, however, he signed the document blessing Toronto, releasing Toronto Police and any of its officers, including Benoit and Mayotis, for any liability for injuries sustained at the time of arrest. Scherzer, 54, Mayotis, 48, Stephen Correa, 44, Raymond Pillard, 47, and Joseph Miched, 53, collectively face 29 charges, including attempt to obstruct justice, perjury, assault, and extortion. The trial continues. That by Peter Small of the Courts Bureau at the Toronto Star. This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at Showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.